Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
So, Jacob,
what are we drinking tonight?
Well, tonight we are drinking a mixed beverage featuring Crown Royal Regal Apple. To create this extraordinary blend, Crown Royal whiskeys are hand-selected by our master blender and infused with Regal Gala apples. The result is a delicious whiskey balanced with notes of crisp apple flavor. Enjoy straight, on the rocks, or in a cocktail, like tonight, for a uniquely smooth experience. Tonight, gentlemen, we're introducing the public to the Crownberry. Crownberry is served over ice, preferably in a Collins glass, but rocks glass works just fine. It is 3 to 4 parts cranberry juice.
I just want to know what I did to offend you so much. And whatever it is, I'm sorry.
Well, sir, what you did to offend me was leave it to the last minute to decide who was bringing the booze, and I had to scramble.
Hey, man, we got a list.
It was either this, or I could bring the Captain Jim, which you would think you had offended me.
Well, I already smelled that Crown Apple, and it smells like Jolly Ranchers that's been stagnating in the sun for a while. So, but you know what? You're right. There's a list. It was your turn. Mm-hmm. I accept that.
Now, one of the reasons I chose the Crownberry is because, first of all, it's a very cheap drink. Second of all, when made properly, it's surprisingly low alcohol. Because, like my friend over here points out, Crown Royal Apple can be a less than desirable smell.
Yes.
Ooh, wow. Yeah, I just took a whiff of this. It's like cleaning solution.
Yes, it is.
Did you want apple-scented dish soap? We got that for you, baby.
I hope I mixed the parts right here, but we're just going to go with it.
You want to go light on the Crown Royal.
Good, that's what I did.
So
I'm going to bring Crown up at some point later. One of my favorite drinks growing up. Well, not really growing up. I guess you're still growing up in your late teens and early 20s. Thanks to my general location and the fact that where I grew up, everybody had RC products. It was a Crown and Crown. Mm-hmm. Simply Crown Royal and Royal Crown. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Actually, one of my favorite things about Royal Crown, probably my only thing I like about Royal Crown, was when I first met you, Nathaniel, you used to tell me how much you liked Crown Royal because, as you said, it was a dice bag that came with a free bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, really nice dice bag that came with free whiskey.
Interestingly enough, that is part of the reason why the Crownberry was selected for tonight's opening drink, gentlemen. Because...
All right, fair enough. I guess there's a theme.
Yes. The Crownberry is featuring Crown Royal Regal Apple. And this drink hits all three of our topics: bikers, dice, and bars.
Okay, I'm missing the biker part.
So, we'll run it in reverse order. Bars. There's actually, I've walked into a couple really low-end dive bars lately, and they will be having the Crownberry as a special. Because, to be perfectly honest, as you're drinking it and as you watch me make it, you're putting maybe half a shot of liquor in there, but it tastes like you put in a shot and a half because of how god-awful strong it smells.
I guess I should probably take a sip so I can understand what you're saying.
Keep going.
It has a good price point from a drinking standpoint if you're in a bar. It's popular in the low-end bar set. It sounds all fancy and stuff. So that's the bar point of it. The dice part of it. If you are a gamer of a certain age, the Crown Royal bag was the gold standard for dice. One of the upsides of Crown Royal Regal Apple is rather than being at a gaming event and going, which purple bag is mine? Since very few people will actually buy and drink Crown Royal Apple, you'll be the only one with a green bag.
Which, after my first sip, I very much understand.
Okay, and finally, tie this in to the road.
To the road. Crown berries are actually popular with a certain subset of, shall we say, backseaters on motorcycles. They prefer it instead of vodka cranberry. Because of that, it fulfills the same function as a alcoholic soft drink. More to the point, it's a tunable alcoholic soft drink, and therefore you can increase the volume and they don't care.
So in translation, did you just call this bitch beer?
Yes, sir.
And if this is your first time listening, which it just might be your last as well, you're listening to Biker Dice and Bars. We record here in Portland, Oregon. I'm Nathaniel, and I have with me two of my favorite locals.
This is Jess Jacob.
And Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And we're here to talk about all things bikes, games, and drinking, and how to combine them in legally responsible ways. So this is a fascinating beverage. It's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Your face, Xander, says otherwise. But this, you know, I'm used to Crown, and I frequently do have vodka or even whiskey crayon when I go drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't so bad. The apple... I might have more to say about it later, but right now I could actually see myself drinking this casually.
2 points on this. One is that when I make these for people, I do something that the original recipe does not call for. I add a shot of Anagostra bitters, which moderates stuff up.
I spaced on that. The bitters are upstairs. I should have brought some down.
It's not a problem.
Oh, I was just going to say if you needed some, I could have brought some, but I was told that there was enough bitterness to go around in this table.
Well, yes, this is true.
Yeah, all of us. Such dark and bitter brooding folks.
The other thing,
former goths, right? All of us?
Yeah,
close enough.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes not former.
There was a thing where I was from called gutter goth, and I was
I was
a gutter goth.
I was basically that too. I was really more of a rivet head. I was way more into industrial music than I was into like crooning and goth music. I could still get down to some classic goth jams.
Oh, yeah.
I'd rather get out there and throw my stomping boots on than my bat catching gloves.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Actually, I used to go to certain goth clubs, and I would protest, actually, when they would play the really super ethereal, flowy stuff. And Euchred and I actually would just go on the dance floor, faint, collapse, refuse to move until that 5-minute song was over, and then we'd get back up and sit back down.
And basically, as a, your music sucks.
Yeah.
This is how much it sucks. I'm sleeping on the floor.
Yeah. No, we would faint and then die on the floor, then stay there in a sprawled out condition for about, until the end of the song. Then we'd go back and wait for something better to come on.
I think I witnessed this multiple times, maybe at Hive or at any of the other goth nights here.
Yeah, over at, I think it was Plan B when it still existed, was where we used to do this a lot.
What happened to Plan B?
It's now the White Owl Social Club.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll have to add that to our list.
Yeah, may that place rest in peace. That was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really good drinks.
Yeah, and White Owl is, it's okay. It's got a decent happy hour, I guess. I don't know. Kind of hipster douche at the moment. It's really bad.
Well, we can add that to the list of postmortems to talk about.
Yeah.
The White Owl has a special spot in my rotation. I concur with everything you said. Good happy bar, happy hour bar, very douchey. It has the perfect point of volume and distance between seating options. In part of my life, when I'm having to have after work non-meetings with coworkers and stuff, it is perfect because you can get there. The music's not overwhelming. You can get a half decent drink at a reasonable price. You can spend the hour and a half there that you're going to spend and then get the hell out of there and go to some place to keep drinking.
Yeah, like the analog.
Exactly.
I made the horrible mistake of going there on Halloween this past year because they were having a Gary Numan tribute band, which is actually one of the better goth bands in town, Vice Device. They have a Gary Numan cover band, so why wasn't I going to go see that? And it was a Tuesday, I think, Halloween was this last year, so I thought it was going to be okay. And just the worst crowd, worst audience ever. And we just bailed as soon as that show was over and went to Gil's Speakeasy, which is
where
which is where the Gary Numan cover band also went after they were done, because they wanted to get the hell out of that place too, because it sucks so bad. And they and we said, oh, we saw your show, but we hated the venue, so we came here. And they said, yeah, us too.
Good job. So now we're going to talk about some bike stuff. We have like no fucking energy tonight, do we?
No, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm raring to go.
Would you say you're revving to go?
Well, as I no longer have something that can rev, I would say no. But I'm changing to a lower gear.
Well, you know, that brings me to one of the topics that we have on our list tonight, which is the perception of bicyclists and how they tend to, well, I think if you're a Portlander and you're listening to this, you know exactly where we're going to go with this. There's so many different ways that people get angry about bikes and get uppity about them. There's so many ways that cyclists get uppity. And there's the truth. Like, somewhere in between is what it's actually like to ride on the road.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I very much consider myself to be a very law-abiding and consistent cyclist. I am the guy who always has his helmet on, because I promised my wife I would do that. I have my lights on at all times, even during the day. Kind of like when I drive, I still have my lights on because it's better visibility and there's no reason not to. I have rechargeable lights, so it's not like I'm wasting batteries.
So you wear your helmet, but where do you put your fancy hat?
In my backpack.
Wow. That's why I have a fancy hat. Why would you shove it into a backpack to get all like munched up and dirty?
So I don't do that with my fancier hats. Just this hat and a handful of other ones that are actually small enough to fit properly into my backpack. But, you know, so I'm one of the guys, I'll stop at every single, you know, stop sign, unless it's an all-way stop and I see that it's clear. I'll be very honest about that. The big thing that comes into conflict here is when you have drivers who either think they're being really nice and are causing an even more dangerous situation in which you have a stop sign, so you stop, and then they stop at their not stop sign and they wave you on and they get mad at you that you don't go.
Yeah.
There's the international sign of, yeah. And it happens all the time. And then it's maddening because then other cars will honk at them or they'll honk at you and just creates this chaotic scene where if everybody just followed the law, it'd all be okay.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Whenever somebody's waving me through, I'm like, no, dude, you have the right of way.
Right.
And you go. That stupid fucking Portlandia sketch is so true in this town.
Yeah. And not just with cars, but also very much with cyclists as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that is irritating. Or, you know, there's certain times too where if you're biking on a street, you do need to take up that full lane as a cyclist because it's the most safe thing for you to be doing as opposed to try to weave in between parked cars in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's just downtown that's really awful like this because I work downtown, so I bike downtown a lot. But there are a lot of drivers who do not appreciate that at all. Even if it's really trafficy and you're all going 5 miles an hour, they still get really cranky about it. And it's hard to not want to go and try to explain to them that this is actually my legal right to take up this entire full lane of traffic right now because it's also safer for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of tourists around. There's a lot of people from the suburbs who don't give a shit.
And now there's lots of people around with those rental bikes
who
are not cyclists at all, don't understand cycling courtesy.
Don't wear helmets.
Yeah.
Ride on the opposite direction on sidewalks.
Oh, God. It's awful. No, not just the opposite direction on sidewalks, but the opposite direction in bike lanes downtown on one-way streets.
Oh, on the bridges a lot, too. I've seen that. Mm-hmm. On the bridges. Like, they're just creating havoc on those things. I just kind of want to punch them all in the face. They're almost worse than the
electric bikes?
No, the Segway tours.
Oh, the Segway tours.
Oh, my God. So, fun story. The Segway tour, the office is right outside my window at my work. I can look out my window and look down across the street and get entertainment every day because they do this multiple times a day. They gather and they give them a Segway lesson up and down. Usually, at least two or three of the people in the bunch totally eats it. They're just it's so hilarious. And then they're like bumbling and bumping into each other, and it's fun to watch. I imagine it's probably a fun tour to take, but I'd rather just walk it. And most of the people that I see taking those tours, they can walk.
They can walk. Yeah. Or they can bike. Right.
They can bike, yeah. I don't know. With the Segway, at least they're on the sidewalk.
right.
Seeing those people on bicycles would probably give me nightmares.
Yeah. I mean, there's also the other thing where I keep wanting to go on one of these larger bicycle tours that they have to places like Hood River, or one of our goals, my wife and I, is to eventually do STP, which is Seattle to Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just about to ask if you had done that.
No, it's in our list of things to do, except that we definitely know that we need much nicer bicycles than the ones that we have right now.
Yeah, probably touring bikes.
Probably touring bikes, because that is doing about 100 miles a day for 2 days.
Have you done the lighter HTC? Hood to Coast?
I have not, but that is the one I've told my wife we have to do a practice run on that first, because she seems to be under the impression that we can just go and do STP next year, and I'm telling her we need to at least know we can go 70 miles in a day before we try to do 100.
And if you're listening and you do not know what that means, here we have on our beautiful eastern skyline the gorgeous peak of Mount Hood looming over the city, and there's an annual ride where a whole bunch of insane cyclists, my opinion, gather at Mount Hood and ride their bikes all the way to the Oregon coast. It's about, what, 100-something miles?
120, I want to say.
Yeah.
It's a ways.
It's, I want to say it's roughly 40 miles shorter than Seattle to Portland.
And it's in one day, and it's much more difficult terrain.
Yes.
All one day? So they don't take multiple days?
Yeah, no. It Hood to Coast is designed to be a one-day thing. And STP, a lot of people do it in two, but there's also a big cadre of people who do it in one day. Because, and my cousin
Maniacs.
Is actually... Well, so my cousin is actually someone who's done the STP, I think, coming up on 7 times now. And his take on it is this. If you are actually in the proper shape to be attempting the STP, pulling over and setting up a dry camp in the middle of nowhere so you can sleep in a shitty sleeping bag for 5 to 6 hours on the hard ground, plus tote all that shit around, is so much of a pain in the ass that it's worth just dropping a gear and riding another 5 to 6 hours and getting her done.
Well, I think with STP, what they actually do, part of the entrance fee is they will take your camping gear and drop it off for you.
Yeah.
If you don't actually
do the check-in place, you can. Yeah. But a lot of the more serious people are like, we're going to ride until we ride. We're done.
So what route do they take for that?
I am unfamiliar with the route. I know my friend Andy did it once. And, you know, so I was at the finish line, which is at a park in near Lloyd Center.
Yep.
That Lloyd Center Park by the Max station there.
Yeah.
Is that
sketchy drug dealer park.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Yeah. It's where you go to finish STP and buy meth.
Yeah.
And I looked at some of these people that were finishing this ride and I thought, my God, if I can't do this ride, I am in way less good shape than I think I am. And kudos to those people who did it, because I feel like I'm in pretty good shape. And some of these people didn't look, but clearly they were. They just rode 200 miles in 2 days.
You know, however,
it was inspiring.
Body flab can be deceiving.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I know some particularly hefty people that are marathon runners. They just, you know, carry weight.
Yeah. But they were very inspiring, the whole thing. And I just thought, I want to do this one of these years. And the funny thing is, all you get at the end is like a free meal and a beer. And I thought, I feel like I probably want a couple at that point.
So let's bring it back to Portland and the cyclists that we have here. Now, I myself am a casual cyclist. I used to ride every day. That used to be my main mode of transportation until I got a motorcycle. And then, again, it's hard to step into my garage and get on two wheels and not get on the one that goes broom. But when I do ride my bike, I really enjoy it. And I really, really hate most of the other people riding around me.
Mm-hmm, 100%.
They feel like they give us a bad name.
Mm-hmm. Like Fixies.
I got nothing against Fixies. You know,
I don't have
every bike has a purpose. It's
people who ride them, though, is what I was trying to say with that. The Fixie is a perfectly fine bike, I guess. But it's the insane bike messengers of this town that just, they scare me. They scare me as a cyclist. They scare me as a driver because I don't know what the hell they're doing. Like, they're crazy on the road. I feel like I'm going to hit one. Not yeah. because I'm breaking the law, because they're driving like, or cycling like maniacs.
Mm-hmm. I did once accidentally hit, well, graze a cyclist when I was on my motorcycle. I was riding through Hillsdale. And I'm riding
my old hood, our old hood.
I was riding right near our old house, and I was riding right around the right past the McMinimans, and there was a bike lane, and this cyclist was listening to headphones and not paying attention, didn't have his mirrors and didn't check his sides, and I'm coming up beside him, and then he just swerves across me because he wanted to go at that split where Capitol Highway breaks. I'm like, no. And then I grazed him, and in my mirror, I saw him like spin off and fumble, but I was maintaining a speed, so I went up to the next, I went up to the Baskin Robbins parking lot, turned around, went to go check on him, and he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Poor guy. Sorry, but hey, you know,
don't cycle like an asshole.
Check your blind spots, man.
Right.
So I think it's a mixture between just maniac cyclists in this town and drivers who don't give a shit about cyclists that just caused that initial conflict and the just misunderstanding between everybody else. Because I'm a daily cyclist. I bike probably 5-6 days a week. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's mostly to and from work. I biked all the way up here, which is a trek. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hills. Thanks for the exercise.
Oh yeah, when I lived in that neighborhood with you, I was not cycling around because the roads were just terrible. It was just,
that's why I had a scooter, actually.
Freaking highway there. People would go too fast, and then the hills were awful.
It's called Hillsdale for a reason. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And when I lived there, I had a scooter, and that was part of the reason I had a scooter was that the hills were just nasty, and it was much easier to be on the road. But where I live now, it's way easier to be a cyclist and way more efficient. So
of the places that you all have lived or visited, would you say that Portland is as bike-friendly as it claims to be?
I would say yes. Yes, it is. Just because this city has become very devoted to ensuring that we have a bike-centric infrastructure, that we have law enforcement that privileges cyclists, and that we have, in addition to that, economic incentives for bicycling. I mean, if you look at any places that have the bike town stands, those Nike-branded, yellow, orange, you know, There's a tax deal going on there. I don't know if everyone's aware of that, but Nike is actually getting a tax deal for installing those.
Oh, I don't doubt it for a second. I can't fathom it being any kind of decision other than a purely business-related one for Nike. They are simply not a humanitarian organization or civic services.
Right. It is not. That said, while Portland is the most bike-friendly bike pack town, for the best lack of a better word, I'd take Minneapolis, St. Paul over Portland any day of the week.
Why?
Simply because just Jacob's getting on a little bit of a rant here, folks. Unlike other communities that have put a commitment in to becoming bicycle-friendly, Portland in part is using the installation of bicycle specific and bicycle preferential infrastructure as excuses to not maintain our current infrastructure and to practice this bullshit road diet concept that PBOT has managed to force on the city. Off the soapbox.
We can go deeper into that. I've got many things to say about that that would take up an entire segment of our show.
So maybe we'll do that another week. But so I would say that my favorite
PBOT. I'm writing in my notes
and underlined. Yeah, I think my favorite city that I've cycled in so far, and I haven't brought my bike to a lot of cities, but even when cities I don't bike in, I look at infrastructure. I would say that my favorite city so far has been Vancouver, British Columbia.
And I've never been there, but I've heard stories.
Yeah, and I like Vancouver, BC for cycling for a number of reasons. And the main one is that they actually have physical concrete barriers that divide the bike lanes, which are two ways, from their streets.
See, that's how it should be, in my opinion.
Yeah, so whereas Portland puts up these really, you know, chintzy plastic things with reflectors on them, which is not going to stop a car if it veers off the side of the road.
It will bring more visible attention, but you're right, it won't stop anything.
Right, right. And that's why we don't have, you know, reflectors on the sides of bridges.
Right.
We have concrete barriers because it's not enough to be visual. You have to stop something that, from trying to actually go over it, intentionally or not.
Well, when it comes to driving or riding, getting around in Portland, you know, the rule is if it's four wheels, then we need to accommodate it. And if it's two wheels, we simply need to raise awareness, which is about as useful as sending them your thoughts and prayers.
Basically, yeah. So Vancouver was nice because it had all these sections. They also had, you know, the same kind of dedicated bike streets that we have here in Portland, which I do think are nice, except that cars take them because there's no stop signs.
We don't have many of them.
As someone who
there's
lives
a fair amount.
As someone who lives next to Clinton, I have some strong opinions on this matter.
But not nearly enough. And again, cars take them because they want to go through an area with no stop signs in a residential area. And that's what cars use them for.
Well, also, cars
why wouldn't
take
you?
Them because they live on those streets. Like,
there's also that.
Here's the thing. If you're going to have a bike exclusive area, then you should make it literally a bike exclusive area. If you're going to take someone's neighborhood where they already live and have cars and infrastructure established for that mode of transportation that we've been using for a century or more, come on. Like, you gotta understand that these people need to get back and forth from their homes. Now, yes, there are douchebags also that for those reasons follow those streets, but sometimes if you're trying to get around, the bullshit that division has become can only be dodged on Clinton Street.
And I'm sure we will dive much more deeply into the Fuck Peabot episode.
Yes.
But I'm just going to put it out here that if you want a microcosm test on how Portland treats four-wheeled vehicles, motorized two-wheeled vehicles, and non-motorized two-wheeled vehicles and pedestrians, all you have to do is spend time around the Powell to Division corridor.
Oh, it's terrible.
And look what they've done over the last 6 years, and you have the entire theory of how Portland is dealing with its traffic problem and its bicycle problem in a just beautiful microcosm.
Well, the city is not making it bike-friendly per se by making it really, really bike-friendly, which I've talked about. There are other cities that do it way better because they actually invest the money into it. This city seems to think if they put some green paint on the ground and make it so miserable to drive that you have no other option but to either take public transit or bike, that you've made it bike-friendly. And that's not the case. You've just made more pissed-off drivers that drive even worse because you've made it a horrible place to drive, which cyclists also have to share the road with those people.
Oh, interesting thing on the green paint. A researcher out of Eugene took a look at that, and there appears to be enough evidence to launch an investigation onto how many motorcyclists have gotten into accidents because they've tried to obey the stay out of the green box, because it ends up forcing you to take a low visibility turn.
Ooh, I would be very interested in hearing more about that.
Me too.
Okay. Another one for the Fuck Peabot episode.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, even that.
For those at home, Peabot is the Portland Bureau of Transportation, which is our city road, quote unquote, maintainers.
The ones who do jack and shit.
Yes. Yeah, in that order.
Except raise awareness. That's all they do.
Plates in the road. Let's not forget
that's a problem everywhere I've lived. At my hometown in Alabama, I lived in Atlanta for 5 years. Even there, it was always just steel plates. It's like, all right, we're doing construction. We ain't finished yet. Let's put some plates down.
Why can't they just run 24-hour crews? This has always been so perplexing to me. If you want to fix a road, you can have 24-hour crews.
Well, you can also do it after hours or on the weekend when cars aren't, you know,
right
in the middle of traffic.
Right. This whole having to work during business hours just seems to be the most obscene thing to me.
It is pretty ridiculous. I think we have a lot to complain about Peabot. I think we should definitely make that a new episode. I think we could probably make like a whole month out of just complaining about Peabot. But enough bitching about Peabot. Let's talk about some nerd shit and let's get some beers.
Yes.
Xander and I have now switched to beers.
Yeah, so I was a little bit frightened thinking about this guy was going to bring in Jacob over here. And so in order to counterbalance that, I brought in from Three Creeks Brewing out of Sisters, Oregon, which if you are not familiar, Sisters is very close to Bend, Oregon, in kind of the middle of the state. The Five Pine Chocolate Porter is what I brought in to you all.
We're eating this.
A robust porter that features 2 pounds per barrel of the finest Belgian chocolate, creating a slightly roasty pint with underlying chocolate sweetness, coming in at a very, very formidable 6.2%.
Oh my God, it's like I'm drinking a candy bar.
I actually didn't realize until just right now that it was actually made with Belgian chocolate, which is kind of exciting.
Wow, it is so chocolatey. It is basically like an alcoholic Yoo-Hoo. This is actually quite delicious. I don't even like porter. But you know what? Enough about beer. Let's talk about some nerd shit. Now, we have, when this launches, we are going to be a little bit of time away from 2 conventions here in the Pacific Northwest. So gaming conventions are something that at least 2 of us, if not 3 of us, have enjoyed. Yeah, I kind of look forward to them every year. They're a nice gathering of people that you really only see a couple times a year, mixed in with people that you probably game with every week. It creates a nice variety of experiences. Now, Jacob, let's talk about GameStorm.
GameStorm. This year is GameStorm 20. It's running April 5th through 8th, and it is at the Red Lion at Jansen Beach, again, a questionable hotel, but, you know, we have a hotel problem in this town, folks.
Well, not just this town, but that town across the river. We're speaking of Vancouver, Washington, Portland's, I guess you could say,
bedroom community.
That's a really nice way to put it.
Yeah, yeah. Stepbrother. Little annoying little stepbrother.
It's the place I go when I can't stand the thought of someone touching my gas.
That's true.
All right, Washington, you got one thing over us. One thing.
You get to pump your gas. And for those of you not familiar with the way the law works, there are 2 states in this great union that do not allow you to legally pump your own gas. I don't know why. Well, okay, I kind of do know why. And regardless, Oregon is one of those 2 states. And
New Jersey
is the other. Fortunately, if you have a motorcycle, you get to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And motorcycles and pretty much any recreational vehicles, you pump your own gas.
That was the nice thing about having my scooter for a while is that they just didn't want to touch it. They just handed you and like, here you go, you do this.
Well, it's a combination of they don't want to touch it and I don't want them to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
But the law doesn't care whether or not you want them to touch your vehicle, but they just don't want to overflow it or anything. They just get really skittish about it because the gas tank size and everything, and they just basically just hand you the nozzle.
Yeah, I just take the nozzle. I don't even wait for them. I pull up my card, I fill out the numbers, I open the gas, I put that shit in. And sometimes they'll come up, hey, you need help? And I'll look at them, and they'll be like, you got it, and walk away.
Anyways.
GameStorm.
Back to GameStorm. GameStorm, annual convention here in Portland, coming on 20 years. It is a all-inclusive gaming convention. It is a gaming-specific convention. Board games, computer games, role-playing games, card games. It's got everything you need. GameStorm's been around for 20 years, born and bred here in Portland, Oregon, even though it spent a number of years across the way in Vancouver, right across the bridge.
That was a choice I'd never fully understood myself. I must say I'm glad it is at least back in Portland and I can take the bus there.
If you ever want to get wonky about it, it's the logistics of hotels in this town, and that is entirely why it drove the move to Vancouver. They hit a certain function space size, and function space is a problem here in Portland. GameStorm is got a couple things going for it. Unlike many gaming conventions, while you pay a entry fee to enter the con as a whole and get your badge, it is a non-ticketed gaming convention.
What do you mean by? Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, I was going to explain because we had enough people here.
Because I was going to ask.
Yeah.
So
it took me a second, but I got you.
I think I know what that means.
Many gaming conventions operate, in fact, most across the U.S., operate in a system where you have to get either specific admission tickets to particular games and events, or you need to purchase general admission tickets that you have to turn in to participate in various games. GameStorm does not do this. While there is a pre-registration system, you're not paying money above and beyond gate price to play different games.
So you just go, you buy your one ticket to GameStorm, and that goes and allows you to go into every single function at this convention.
Correct.
So my understanding of things like Comic-Con is that you have a general admission ticket, and if you want to go into X panel or Y panel or Z panel, there could be potential other fees and ticket prices for those types of things, as well as participating in certain games.
That is correct. While there is a pre-registration system where people can sign up for spots in specific games in advance, because let's face it, games have a certain number of players.
There's a cap.
There's a cap. There is no price to play, with one exception. And that is GameStorm's rapidly increasing charity track, Games for Charity. It was kicked off by the local Men in Black, who are the promotion company, promotion group for Steve Jackson Games. And they play different Steve Jackson games where there is literally people standing around a game of Munchkin throwing money on the table to make cheating legal, to put things into place, etc., etc. It makes some games that I find kind of questionably fun to begin with really fun.
Well, I mean, one of the rules of Munchkin anyways is you can cheat as long as no one catches you.
Right. And in this point, it's making that cheat out loud for play.
Back when I lived in Atlanta, I regularly went to Dragon Con. And the first game I ever actually technically published, well, at least released to the consumers, was a live-action role-playing game called Streetwise, the live-action role-playing game of criminal economics. But everybody else just called it the Pimps and Hoes game. So it was a game about being criminals and trying to constantly one-up each other. It was a very tongue-in-cheek, very humorous. We silently encouraged cheating. We had no rules against cheating, and we actually had rules against whining. So it was the mechanic, the core conflict mechanic of the LARP. Like, you know, some people will use paper, rock, scissors. Some will use playing cards. We used a game called Pencil Break, where every character had a life stick, which was a pencil. We thoroughly stress tested dozens of different types of pencils. I spent so much money on pencils, you guys. And we came up with a set of three pencils. And your pencil denoted how, you know, strong you were. Pencils could break when somebody attacks you or when you attack somebody else. Well, you could also just take someone's pencil and break it when they weren't looking. And that happened a couple times, and someone came up to us like, man, this guy took my pencil. This guy broke my pencil. Can I get another one? I'm like, nah, dude, you're dead. You shouldn't have left your pencil around where some asshole could take it.
That's like the equivalent of letting someone come back right behind you and just cap you in the back of the head.
Well, yes, that. But our rule was, unlike many other LARPs, once you're killed, you actually come back into play 15 minutes later. Because you cap some punk on the street, some other punk's just going to take
your place.
This time it just happens to be the same guy and he wants to kill you.
It's interesting that you bring up one of the first games you developed and ran. Because one of the things that GameStorm prides itself on and has had some degree of success with is a subtrack of it called Game Lab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Game Lab is a separate organization from the GameStorm convention, but they have a long-running partnership. What Game Lab is that if you are a game designer, bring your game in whatever stage development it is, and they will get you table time for people to come up.
Play test it.
For note, it's board games.
For board games, card games, yes. Et cetera, et cetera. However, they're starting to expand into role-playing games as well.
That's actually awesome. That's really exciting because I did have a concept game that I wanted to develop at some point, and to actually know there's a place to go to actually play test it makes me really excited.
Now, interestingly, one of the things about GameStorm is it usually falls right around Gamma, which is the trade organization for games. And it's not uncommon for some of the bigger developers to show up at GameStorm after Gamma to partially decompress from one of their big weekends of the year and to sit there and play test that wild hair game they have and sit around and talk to other designers. Casey, who runs Game Lab, makes a point of doing several hosted events for well-established professionals and up-and-coming developers to meet and talk about game development. And so GameStorm has gotten a rep as being a place that if you're in the Pacific Northwest and you're doing game development, stop by. You're going to get a very broad section of people sitting down at your table and trying your game.
Especially for board games. GameStorm has a huge board game area. It seems to be like that's their big focus is on actual at the tabletop board gaming.
That's awesome because I do miss playing a good board game.
Board games, card games, role-playing games, live-action role-playing games. They got it all, small computer system set up.
And I think it's a 100% volunteer-run organization.
It is a... Yeah. So in the interest of disclosure, I have some association with the organization, and it is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Oregon Science Fiction Conventions does run GameStorm and its sister convention, Oricon. And they are a nonprofit organization. A big chunk of their take that isn't retained for future cons goes to charity.
Gaming for
That's
a cause.
That's pretty awesome.
I like that. Oh, hence the mad gambling on Munchkin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't worry.
Wait, whoa. Time out.
It's not gambling.
It is a donation to for charity in exchange
for the children.
Questionably unethical playing of the game Munchkin.
Which is a game that I just don't play anyway because it's I consider the whole game questionably unethical. So there we go. And another convention that's coming up is one that I am very fond of. This is their third year. It is a brand new convention here in Oregon, specifically in a small town off the Interstate 84 corridor called The Dalles. This convention is called Wagon Con, and it is run by a good friend of mine who I actually met through GameStorm. I met him first one year when he ended up playing in a playtest of mine for another game that I was designing. His name is Aaron, and his buddy is Matt. They together run this convention, Wagon Con. It's an entirely community-focused event. I don't think they make a dime off of it, but they do focus very heavily in involving the entire Dalles community in the running and benefit of this convention, including bringing in a local Boy Scout troop to go run and get food for you. And I think they like support some of the local special needs schools and development.
Yes, they do. In a very big way.
Yeah.
So for those of you who may not be familiar with Oregon's geography, but might have grown up in the late 80s or early 90s and played Oregon Trail, the Dalles, the crossing of the Dalles is one of the last things that you do in the game to get to Oregon. So that is a real place. It does exist.
Yeah.
And this is where this convention, I'm sure that's where the name comes from, I assume.
It's the Dalles is the name of this town.
No, I mean Wagon Con. It's called Wagon Con because of the Oregon Trail connotation.
No, the Dalles has like a history of fort. There's an old fort there. There's a museum. They have a bunch of like a lot of historical sites there that you can visit. You can follow the Lewis and Clark Trail. It's really heavily focused on the Oregon Trail and that era of our history.
Just saying, I love playing that game. And when I realized that was an actual place, it was kind of like when I played Odell Lake when I was a little kid. You played that?
I've never heard of that. Odell Lake?
Odell Lake was a game where you were a fish. And depending on...
The look on your face, Nathaniel.
That's great. So, again, I was a fisherman, so this is exciting
for me. The only fish game I ever played was Echo the Dolphin.
Yeah, so depending on the sound that you heard when you were a certain kind of fish, you would either have to, like, dive up, dive down to escape, an osprey, or you'd have to go and eat this certain thing or run away because a bigger fish was coming after you, really horrible like 8-bit graphics. And I always thought, cool, this is a game called Odell Lake. And then I moved to Oregon and realized Odell Lake's in Southern Oregon and it's a real place and it has all these fish in it.
So the game was about the actual lake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So yes, if you are a fan of Oregon Trail game, then you should follow the Oregon Trail and come on down to the Dalles. This convention is in May. It's May 4th through 6th this year. Again, this is their third year running. I am a big fan. I'm actually a guest of honor at the convention this year. Ooh. And I'm going to be doing recording for at least one podcast there. Hopefully this one as well. I'd love to get you guys there.
Well, you've given me too much notice, so I should be able to at least try to be able to make that.
You know, I'm not sold, Nathaniel, because, you know, you've invited me to this con. You've told me about the fact I can get Boy Scouts to fetch me food.
Which,
but what can I do there?
Well, what you can do there is hang out with the roughly 100 other attendees at this small, comfortable, cozy, friendly, and familiar convention and play board games, card games, role-playing games. I think they may even have a LARP.
So to ask, what makes this particular gaming convention different than other ones outside of maybe the size of it?
It's the size of it.
Okay, that's a big thing.
100% the size.
Okay.
Well, first off, it's the size mixed with a few things. Like, there's a feel of camaraderie in the air. You don't have any, you don't have to deal with smelly gamer problem that you do at some other conventions. Everybody there is, by the end of the first day, you know everybody there. You've probably played in a couple games with them, and you're all friendly. You all go out to eat together. It's so,
when the Boy Scouts bring you the food,
and you can order runners with the Boy Scouts.
Nice.
So I'm going to run down my lists of reasons I avoid small cons, and I'm going to ask you to counter each and every one of them on why Wagon Con doesn't meet this criteria.
Bring it.
You know, small cons, you know, cons that are less than 150 people, especially 100 or less, frequently are kind of cliquish. Everybody there already knows each other. If you're not from the area or from that particular scene, it's really hard to get in. You're just walking around watching a bunch of friends yammer at each other.
Everybody there already knows each other, and they want you to know them too. They come up to you. They shake your hand. They welcome you. Thank you for attending their convention. Shower you with good cheer and warm energy and hang out and have a rip-roaring good time.
Point the second. Small cons, especially cons in small towns, which, given where I grew up, I know a thing or two about, frequently suffer from a lack of total number of games.
There's a lot of games here. So they take up the entire Dalles Civic Auditorium, which, we're from Portland, we're used to a huge place. This place is much smaller. It's like a super-sized fellowship hall from a church kind of place. But there's games of all different types. It is mostly RPGs in the area of the building that I hung out in, but they also have a board game and card game area. And last year, they had the Double Clicks play there. If you're familiar with the Double Clicks, they are like a pair of ladies who do geek, folky kind of music, and they're really
Jane, the man they call Jane.
Yeah, so they performed there last year at the convention.
So point the three, a third. When I go to a gaming convention, I'm all about gaming, but occasionally I want to do things other than gaming. Obviously, you've answered that one already. They do offer other entertainment than just gaming.
Yes.
So point the fourth. And to be honest, this may say something about me. It may say something about the part of the Midwest I'm from. But God damn it, I'm going to a gaming convention. How close is the bar?
There's a good number of bars. In fact, at least last year, on the last night of the gaming convention, the hosts took any of the adult attendees who wanted to go and run their games at a different location to a nearby bar to run their games there. And they had rented out an entire big section of this of a brewery.
I am sold, sir. I will be there.
Yes, there's lots of adult stuff. There's actually a couple of dive bars right a walk around the corner that I would love to visit and review.
Really, sir? Does this mean field trip?
Tax deductible, my friend.
Oh, you had me at tax deductible.
So that is coming up May the 4th. So, Jacob, remind me again the dates of Game Storm.
Game Storm is April 5th through 8th. And I'd like to point out that Game Storm runs from April 5th to April 8th. It literally starts 8 a.m. in the morning on the 5th.
And the 5th is Thursday, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so it's a four-day convention, although they end early on the Sunday.
They do end early on the Sunday. That may not actually be the case this year. In the past, the early end on Sunday has been a function of their contract with the hotel, and it's been something they've rubbed up against every single year because they have to start teardown.
Yeah.
If the contract did get modified and they don't have to do teardown until Monday, we might have a all-night Sunday Game Con.
That could be cool. And then Wagon Con is 1 month later on May the 4th, and it shuts down on May the 6th. So we hope to see you folks there, all of our many listeners who have only been listening to us for about a week before it starts.
Nathaniel, come on. We're serious about this venture. Folks, this looks like it's going to be our first live recording. If you want to be in at the ground floor of this, be at Wagon Con.
I would say if you want to be on the ground floor, hitch your wagons.
Yeah.
Take them to Wagon Con.
Hop on that Oregon Trail, ford that river, and cross, if you make it to the other side, we'll be there waiting for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to point out one thing. While you will have to pay admission to Wagon Con, the hosts of Bikers, Dice, and Bars would gladly support your contributions to the cause of quality recording by any beverages you care to drink and bring for our consumption.
Especially if you wanted to meet us at one of those currently unnamed dive bars around the corner. And speaking of dive bars, yeah, let's go ahead, Xander, and open one more of these five pines.
Pass me one of those.
And we're going to pass Jacob one, too.
Thank you.
Let's check in on what we've been drinking so far. So I think we've already had a hefty amount of discussion on the, what the hell was it called again?
Crown Royal Regal Apple.
The cranberry or crownberry.
Crownberry? Crown yep. Apple?
Crownberry.
Crownberry?
Yep.
Sounds like a fruit from, you know, like the Smurfs or something. What are you guys having? We're having the crownberries.
I could see myself drinking that casually. I think I've already said that. It, however, seems like headache juice.
Yeah.
Sometime, Nathaniel, let me do you a tarted up version of that, and I think you'll like it.
Okay, with bitters and everything.
With bitters and
quality.
And quality cranberry juice.
I'll give it a shot. I'm not writing it off my list, Xander.
I am writing this off my list. I don't like sweet drinks at all. I appreciate Ocean Spray's no sugar added, but it was also a bunch of grape juice and apple juice and stuff like that added to it.
Yeah.
So. That's not really my...
That is not juice.
You know, Xander,
it's not really
like,
my bag.
It sounds like you and I need to have a small sit-down and a conversation, because I feel that since we have started this recording, I may have led you astray on your opinion on my credentials as a consumer of alcoholic beverages.
No, because the first time we actually sat down and talked, we had a really good discussion about really good cocktails. And so I don't know if you're just fucking with me or I offended you or whatever it was, but I know that you have good taste in cocktails, but I'm also willing to go and try any kind of drink that I may or may not think that I would like, because that is what experimentation and knowledge and education is for.
Oh, great. I have a friend who's coming back into town. He'll get me a load of Punto.
Go on.
I'm going to just let that one hang there, and we'll move on to the rest of the segment.
This is not the same thing in which you were trying to get us to go and eat, you know, venomous glands of whatever the hell is it?
No, this is prison wine.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
One day, maybe we will feature that as our beverage. Today is not that day. Today, we're going to talk about what makes a dive bar. Or today, we're going to talk about what makes a bar a dive bar. Now, regardless of what we come 2 as our decision. I suspect part of that description will not include serving crown berries.
I would argue that, sir. I would say that that's...
I would agree with you, sir, 100%.
Well, then, I think we have our first metric that we have to define.
So, okay, let me tell you what I think a dive bar is. A dive bar is a place, you kind of got to feel it. It's got low lights. It's got probably a neon sign that's flickering outside. It's got maybe a pool table that's off-level that nobody uses, or the people that do use are the regulars because they know how to work with the strange leveling of the pool table, and there's probably going to be a bar fight there. In fact, the pool cues are probably the newest things there because they have to keep getting new ones. That's what I think of a dive bar, with or without naked people.
Okay, the naked people is an interesting aspect to that. So
most every dive bar I've ever been to has actually been a strip club. So that's, you know.
Okay, that's fair. Okay, now I see where you're going with that. So for me, Portland's an interesting place because I think some bars have wanted to try to make themselves a dive bar, which you just can't do.
If you advertise yourself as a dive bar, you're not a dive bar.
You're not a dive bar.
I would say there's only one exception with that in the city, and that's Billy Ray's.
How long has Billy Ray's existed?
I think at least 20 or 30 years.
Okay, I guess by that point, you can probably start adding it to the description if the moniker fits.
I mean, its technical name is Billy Ray's Dive Bar, but
right.
But that neon sign outside just says Billy Ray's. Billy Ray's is great.
Right.
So, yeah, to define a dive bar, it can't be created to be as such. It just kind of exists as is. And I will go off of Nathaniel's description in saying that the low light is a good indicator of a nice dive bar. And having worked in the industry a lot, I know that a lot of those kind of neon signs, the beer signs and all the posters they put up, that's all free promotional material that owners will take because they don't want to spend the money to go and put up their own. And so that's another good indication is that they're kind of low budget. You know, they're just trying to exist to go and sell you a stiff, good drink. And, you know, it's a place that usually everybody knows, probably 80% of the patrons that ever walk into that place, because they're all friends. They've been drinking there for probably 20 or 30 years together at this point. There's nothing too terribly fancy on the menu because they don't really care. You know, it's usually a working class bar, which I think is another good indication that you're at the right place, is that it's for people who just don't have a lot of money, just want to go and like blow off some steam and have a good time.
In order to get to the heart of this issue, I'd like each of you to list 3 bars here in Portland that are the archetype of dive bar to you.
Okay, let me go. Xana's going to be mad because I'm going to claim Gil's Speakeasy because Xander introduced me to that on his birthday party, and it was amazing. It rekindled my appreciation for the nightlife, for the seedier nightlife in this town, complete with the swaying old drunk guy outside who's just sort of standing there swaying aimlessly, looking at the sky, and then he goes back in and has another shot of whiskey. That's one. The Yam Hole.
You've taken all of my bars.
The Yam Hole, Yam Hill Pub, aka the Yam Hole. Its bathroom is an EPA Superfund site, in my opinion. When you go to the Yam Hole and you need to go to the bathroom, you don't actually go into the bathroom to pee. You go to the bathroom, you open the door, and then you pee into the bathroom. Because if you don't, then you're going to be stepping in the pee of all the other people who have done what you should have done. And then finally, the Pirates Cove Strip Club, right around the corner from my house. It is an amazing place. It's quite a dive. Its owner will tell you this, and I'm going to try and get that guy on our show sometime. I love the Cove. I consider it a local, my local. It's a great dive. Xander?
Well, now that you've taken 2 of my 3.
Well, I figured that you knew more than me, so you could fill in the blanks.
Yeah, I'm going to have to now. So one other thing I will say about the restroom at the Yam Hill, the Yam Hole, is that there's not a men's room and a women's room. There's the bathroom that locks and the one that doesn't.
The men's room and the women's room.
Yeah. Yeah. There's the one that locks and the one that doesn't. There's no signage on the door. It's just known. But so I'm going to go. I've already talked about it before. I'm going to give a little shout out to Billy Ray's Dive Bar. I met one of my best friends there who's an Englishman. Got into a discussion about politics that lasted from when I bumped into him at midnight until about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then I had one of his friends' place. It is a place that is cash only. They got like the little video lottery, lottery in the corner over there. They serve like 24-ounce beers if you want them to in big old like frosty steins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they have the outdoor smoking patio because that's kind of what you have to have at a dive bar. Since Oregon went smoke free a number of years ago. They have the really shitty ping pong tables out back that only sometimes are even playable. And a great neon sign out in front. They have an upstairs, which is only sometimes open, that has really great pinball machines up there that usually work. That place I love. I'm going to give a shout out to probably one of my absolute favorite places I don't go to nearly enough, which is Papa Sun's.
Oh.
This guy knows. Papa Sun's is way out in outer southeast Portland. I think it's Southeast Powell and 125th. Mm-hmm. And for those of you at home, after you get out past, I would say probably 42nd, people start to not think of you as Portland anymore. There's a certain barrier in which like you're just Gresham to them.
I fucking hate that too.
But I'm right.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I will say that that has changed in recent years just because of the housing situation.
It keeps going out. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're
now,
right.
Now I'd say the line is roughly like 82nd.
82nd. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So anyways, yeah,
that Montevilla area has become pretty banging. Mm-hmm.
So Papa Sun's is on, I think it's 125th and Powell or so. And Papa Sun's, they have their $2, $3, $4, $5 drink menu. Last I was there, which was a couple years ago, but it starts at like $2 for, you know, a vodka energy drink special, and it goes down from there, or I guess up, depending on how you look at the situation. I mean, I went there once, and the KJ was so excited to show me his super fancy thing that he had that he couldn't make work when he was trying to show it to me. He's like, yeah, so you just type in someone's name, it'll pull up all the songs they've ever sung before, so you can know what to do. And then he showed it, and it didn't work. And then he was frustrated and felt embarrassed, but then like was adamant that it was true, that it worked. All the drink specials are like super ridiculously cheap and bad liquor. You look like someone like me. You walk into that place and they're like, so where are you from? Well, I live in this city, Portland.
You no, do no, no, like but, a Yankee. I mean, you yeah. do look like a Yankee.
You do.
Yeah, no, but where are you from? Like, I'm from this city. Yeah, but where are you from? It's a really interesting experience, and I love those people out there. Down to earth, great. They have swinging porch swings on the back patio, which is also really fun. And if I have to pick another one, because you've taken two of my three that I was going to talk about.
I got to make it difficult on you.
You know, I'm actually going to go to one of the few places that I would kind of consider to be a modern dive, because it's kind of a punk rock dive, and that's the Hungry Tiger.
No. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Man's allowed his opinions. We'll make him defend it later.
Go for it.
Yeah. So the Hungry Tiger is kind of like a shithole punk rock dive, which I love about it. It kind of has some of like the hipsterisms of like all of our dishes can also be made vegan because mm-hmm. Oregon has a law in which you have to sell food at all of your bars. But I mean, they just like saddled the place up with the most like gaudy, awful tiger art I've ever seen in my entire life, specializing now in a bunch of velvet paintings of naked women with tigers that I'm pretty sure are from the 70s.
Did you ever go to Hungry Tiger number one?
Yes.
So that was a fucking dive. Rest in peace.
In nomine Patris,
you know, but this place, you know, it has all of the awesome, you know, tagging everywhere. It has really good service industry specials, which I think is nice. It's definitely not the older crowd that a normal dive bar usually, I would say, has to entail.
But they also have fishbowl drinks with fancy names.
At the Tiger?
The Hungry Tiger 2 in no. Southeast?
No.
The Hungry Tiger 2.
I smell a field trip. We have a point.
The one with the big old tiger on the outside in the back patio?
Yeah, they don't have fishbowl drinks. Yeah,
they have fishbowl drinks. That's what I drink when I go to the Hungry Tiger 2.
Ladies and gentlemen, obviously, my two...
They have a photo booth.
They don't.
My two friends have a difference of opinion.
I live three blocks away from there. I go there all the time.
There is only one answer.
I used to live three blocks
There is only one
there.
Answer. We will be taking a field trip to the Hungry Tiger 2.
They have vegan brunch.
They don't anymore.
They do.
It was two places. It was a restaurant side and a bar side, and now it's just a bar.
Did they separate the restaurant?
There's no restaurant anymore.
What happened?
It's now just all the bar.
Oh. I don't know. I've had fishbowl drinks at the Hungry Tiger.
There will be a field trip report,
ladies and
gentlemen.
We're going to have a field trip.
Yeah.
Delicious, fruity,
fruity fishbowl drinks, the kind that you take
under the old ownership that used to be there. Actually, this in our notes at one point was like talking about the new ownership of the Hungry Tiger.
Yep. We should do that. Apparently, I've been out for a while.
Yep.
Yeah, no, the Tiger's legit.
Well, the Hungry Tiger 2 restaurant breakfast was banging.
It was.
I miss it. Okay, so that's your third?
That's my third.
All right, Jacob.
First one I will put on the list is Tom's Bar. Tom's is a sort of complex on the corner of 39th and Division. There is Tom's.
Oh, I know Tom's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom's restaurant.
Not to be confused with Todd's.
Right. Right. Entirely different place. Although you can get good meth there.
That's a gaming reference that we'll explain at some point in the future.
So Tom's is a complex. On one side, you have Tom's restaurant, which is actually kind of a classic diner and is a great place to have classic diner food. However, for this, we are talking about Tom's Bar. Tom's Bar has been there for at least 20 years. I've heard dates going from 40 to 50. It's one of the few places in town where they actually have a Budweiser tap.
Okay.
You can get basic mixed drinks there. You can get basic beer there. You can get the mandatory, because we're in Oregon, artisanal craft microbrew. And you can play some skee ball. And you can smoke like a chimney out in front of it. And no one's going to bitch if you're 3 feet away from the front door.
Right on.
Can I just say about that really quick? I went to the pub at the end of the universe, if any of you are familiar with that place.
You mean the bar at the... Okay. So yeah. I thought you meant Bog. I apologize.
No, the pub at the end of the universe is in Woodstock neighborhood here. And one of the first times I went there, it was just like a year or two after the smoking ban in Oregon. And I walked in there and I went... So weird. It smells like an old bar in here. And at the end of the bar was this lady who had a coffee tin in front of her and was just like chain smoking cigarettes. And I just went, huh, that's so weird. I didn't think you could do that in Oregon anymore. And she just turned around and looked at me and said, honey, I've owned this bar for 25 years and ain't no one in Salem going to tell me what I can and cannot do in my bar. To which the bartender quickly said, yes, although we do not encourage you to smoke in this place. It's still against the law. As she just keeps puffing away.
So, right on.
Cheers to that.
I myself am torn in that. Well, you know, we could bait this another topic of discussion for another day.
Second bar.
Smoking in bars, that kind of stuff. That said to me, a good dive bar, I walk in, I walk out, and I smell like it within 5 minutes.
I think a discussion for another time, but we can go into that.
Yeah.
My second entry in the category of dive bar is an edge case. Claudia's. Claudia's on Hawthorne.
Yes.
Claudia's, by some people's counts, qualifies as an old school sports bar.
I would agree with that. It's a sports dive, I would call it.
It is a hybrid. It has that above two TV screens, and a couple of them are high quality, that it does have a small sports bar vibe there. However, it's been there for fucking ever. If you come in your skinny jeans, people are going to be giving you the hairy eyeball, unless you've been coming in there since you were 21. And then it's like, he's Roy. He's been here forever. And yeah, he uses way too much pomade, but you know, he's okay.
Uses pomade for his five remaining hairs.
Yeah.
No, I actually really enjoy Claudia's. They have the really awesome, royally huge seats at the bar, which are just like giant old men lounge chairs, which I really enjoy. It's like the thing you'd see in your grandfather's study.
Nice.
So I do like that. And they run poker in the back room.
Yes. Are we supposed to be talking about that? Are we sure that that's on the up and up? Or
they advertise it on the outside of their building. I'm sure they know that that's what they're doing there.
My last entry on the category of dive bar is, again, one that you may consider an edge case. It's Chew's. C-H-U apostrophe S. It is out on Powell at roughly 170th.
That's a deep cut, man.
I don't think Portland goes out that far. I think Portland cuts off at 162nd.
No,
or
Portland
so.
Still goes through my 180
brother,
something.
My brother, yeah, you really? Are not even officially in Rockwood yeah. yet, let alone Gresham.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyways, Choose Bar is attached to Choose Chinese Restaurant. However, it is one of those classic late 1960s through late 70s Chinese restaurant operations, which has a semi-separated bar that you could walk in through a separate entrance, and it's a full-service bar. It's been there forever. It is very popular with the broad section of the community that lives out there. It's a place that you can go in, and if you ask for bullet bourbon, it's only maybe that they're going to have it on the shelf. That said, everybody there knows each other. Everybody there has known each other for as long as they've lived there. Many of them grew up drinking in the bar, literally grew up drinking in the bar. It's comfortable. It's cozy. And it is one of the broadest cross-sections of humanity where I can go and drink in Portland.
So we have spent all of this time talking about dive bars that we like. Let's do a quick recap before we shut this down, because we haven't actually identified what the two of you classify a dive bar as. So, Xander, give me your description of a dive bar.
I would say a good dive bar is a place that when you walk into it, most people know each other. I would say when you go in there, it's hard to see. I would say when you walk in there, you are not terribly... I would say when you walk in there, you know, the selection of drink is basically geared exclusively towards our normal local clientele, because most people there just want to get a quick, cheap drink that is strong.
And the owners know what their clientele want and wants to save money on anything else.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. It's a place that's usually very low budget, so they don't really care when their, you know, couches or, you know, seats get torn up. That's just part of the patina after a while. And it's a place where, you know, if you go on the jukebox and you play anything that ain't Hank or Merle, they'll fix that real fucking quick for you.
Okay. Or David.
David Allen Cole.
Don't forget David.
Or Johnny.
Or Johnny.
Or Patsy.
Willie.
Patsy.
Yeah. Loretta.
Waylon.
Yeah.
Waylon. No, we're going down a dive hole here.
Yeah.
Jacob.
For me, a dive bar is, part of it is a product of age. You can't open a bar that's going to be a dive bar. Dive bars are small local bars that don't ever try to be more than the local bar and are just grow into that status. They have, much like you pointed out, sir, there's this comfort level when you walk in. It's like putting on an old pair of slippers. Nobody's there to impress. That's the comfort thing. On the back end, usually they're running at about a 19 to 22% alcohol charge up, and they frequently have less staff than you'd usually see in most other locations. That's just
like
on the business
one person.
End. Like
usually.
One person.
Yeah.
The bartender is also the cook and the barback and the bartender. And
if by cook, you mean the fryer or the microwave.
That's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
It also helps if you walk in and you have a reasonable and you have an honest reason to believe that a big portion of the people who are sitting there drinking either are retirees or work at jobs that are Fred Meyer or less,
or have also been there since 7 a.m.
Same difference.
Also, I would say a good dive bar also opens up at close to the legal hour to sell alcohol as well.
What is the legal hour in the
7
state?
7 a.m. in the state of Oregon, unless you're in the airport, in which case you can sell, I believe, starting at 5 a.m.
Right on.
I actually looked that up the other day.
Well, I grew up in Alabama, where it was illegal to imbibe alcohol on a Sunday, let alone sell it. And then I lived in Atlanta for a while, which is strange because for the first year or so when I lived in Atlanta, closing time for bars was 4 a.m.,
it's New York City time right there.
And then they changed it back down to 2:30 to match with like what most people here are familiar with. And for a while, you could not buy anything past any liquor from a liquor store past 11 p.m. on a Saturday, not at all on a Sunday. And then I think they changed it again after I moved away.
Which, again, even by Oregon standards, sounds nice.
Well, so the problem with Oregon is that you can, liquor stores are open on Sunday. Yeah.
Some of them are open on Sundays.
Well, there's no law saying they can't be. It's entirely up to the store. Whereas in Atlanta, every liquor store I ever visited was open until freaking 11. They were open as late as they possibly could to get as much money as they could.
Absolutely.
Here in Oregon, they're like, well, we're just going to close when we feel like it. We close at 7. Why? Because we want to.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we want to. But don't you want money? Nah, we're good. But I will give you money for booze.
Yeah,
it's, come back tomorrow.
It's a side effect of the whole agency state tax scam model that we have operating.
I mean, the OLCC, part of their mission statement is to promote temperance within the state of Oregon. So that is a real thing. And on top of that, too, I will tell you, every time I go back to California, it's awesome because they sell you hard liquor until about 2 o'clock in the morning at a grocery store if they're open because they don't care. Which, again, wouldn't you rather have somebody be taking that bottle of liquor home than closing out a bar and driving? Like, I don't understand the logic to me. It makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't either. It's silly. It's fucked up. But you know what?
We deal.
We deal.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
Well, folks, I am now two tumblers of that Crownberry and two of these Three Creeks Five Pine Chocolate Porters in. What about you guys?
I feel as though I'm in the same place as you, although I took a Crown Royal apple with a little straight apple, and then I added a little cranberry later because, as I said, I didn't know if it could be worse by itself or not, and the answer is yes, it is worse by itself. And so I had to add more cranberry to it, but I did have about the same as you.
But then you realize you're drinking Ocean Spray cranberry, so you have to add more booze to balance that flavor out.
The struggle is real with this cocktail. I'm not going to lie, Jacob, as I glare at you from across the table.
So in other words, you're saying I shouldn't tell you, my good doctor, what else was in the bag over there?
You son of a bitch.
You have mentioned more? If I look in that bag and there are legitimately good things to drink in there, I might throw the rest of my drink at you.
So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Perhaps we'll have a next episode. Perhaps we'll have an episode with only two hosts. Come back next week.
It was nice knowing you, Jacob.
This is a bar fight that's going to happen right now.
So just to recap, I'm Nathaniel.
I'm just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And today we talked about all different kind of things nerdy-wise, but I want to remind our listeners that coming up in a couple weeks is Game Storm. And Jacob, what were the dates on that again?
The 4th through 9th of April.
And then coming up a month after that, our Wagon Con, May the 4th through 6th. We hope to see you there. Thanks for listening, and rubber side down.
Also, note, too, that if you have any questions or comments in regards to anything you've heard in this episode, please do not hesitate to send them our way, and we will go and remark upon them, probably.
You can actually email us individually. I am NPC at Bikers. I am NPC at BikerDiceAndBars.com.
I am Just Jacob at BikerDiceAndBars.com.
And I am Dr. Wait. I'm just going to make it easy. Xander Gerrymander at Bikers Dice.
You son of a bitch. I have to add that now.
The doctor's hard to add. Because they don't know if it's DR or if it's D-O-C-T-O, you know?
Doctor's hard to add. Doctor's, how the hell do you spell gerrymander?
And on that note, thank you for listening.
It's named after Governor Eldridge Gerry. Like, did you not know this? I thought everybody knew this.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes. Bikes, Dice, and Bars. Bikes, Dice, and Bars.
fucking time. Are you kidding me?
Yep.
Are you kidding me? No, you made me drink this fucking apple poison. Like, this is like what Snow White was fucking warned about. Was it Snow White? I don't even give a shit. But you had the fucking whiskey that won the Civil War. Oh, you're going to sip that in front of me now like an asshole. You had that the whole time. You made me drink this. You're a bad man. You are a bad man. And you, Nathaniel, are a friend of a bad man.